KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, Houston's community station, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
Remember that there is an election going on. Early voting has started. This is for primary runoffs and precinct chair elections. Your ballot may vary. The first day of early voting was Monday, and it will end this Friday, and then Election Day is Tuesday next week. So don't forget to vote. It does matter, maybe now more than ever. Okay, and our first story from CommunityImpact.com, Tomball votes to deny change to comprehensive plan that would prevent medical complex drive extension from completion. Headline's a little confusing, but and it's short. The proposed change would have canceled the extension of Medical Complex Drive between Huffsmith-Corville and Mahaffey Roads, and council members said they did not want to give up yet fully on extending Medical Complex Drive all the way from west of Highway 249 to FM 2920. Harrisburg Homes requested the city amend the city's comprehensive plan and not extend Medical Complex Drive for the 0.9-mile segment between east of Huffsmith-Corville and south of Mahaffey, as it would cut through a development and specifically a house, according to Harrisburg Homes home builder Sean Spear. Community Development Director Nathan Dietrich said the city's Planning and Zoning Commission met about the request and voted unanimously to deny the case as a recommendation for what council should do. In other words, they didn't vote to go ahead with it. The commission was concerned how the city can make it easier to get across the city without the Medical Complex Drive extension being complete, and whether the traffic patterns have changed enough to justify removing this segment, Dietrich said. Dietrich said another reason this proposed change was brought before council was because the extension was downgraded, and this is interesting, from a three-lane road on each side of a divider to a two-lane road on the western side, presumably leaving a three-lane road on the other side, therefore bringing into question whether Medical Complex Drive is a true bypass and if the traffic relief is still needed. So this is a really local story with more local details, but I thought it was interesting on several other levels. First, that Tomball has a Planning and Zoning Commission. Houston could use one of those. Second, it demonstrates the importance not just of city master planning, but of cooperative regional master planning. When cities and adjacent developing lands abut each other, large-scale, forward-looking planning is essential for mobility and livability, and for landowners and prospective land buyers. Local and regional governments everywhere need to do a better job of this to anticipate land use conflicts. So, I mean, there are several other there are things here.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I've been in Houston long enough to remember when widening Westheimer Road in the Galleria area was a thing.
Mm.
And at the time, I think it was two lanes each way. And they figured that by taking some of the city's easement and narrowing the lanes, that they could, I think it was, get three lanes in one direction and two lanes in the other, or four lanes in one direction and three lanes in the other. I forget. But when I'm reading this story, what I'm kind of getting is that we'd be going from six lanes to five lanes. And it's like, if there are three lanes going east and two lanes going west, does that mean there are always going to be more people leaving than returning? Isn't that kind of like when your grandparents used to say that they used to have to walk to school in the snow, uphill, in both directions? Anyway, I mean, I think that even though this is a really local story, I think it provides some food for thought in a lot of different areas. Andrew?
Yeah. The one thing that I really was wondering when reading this is the home that they say this extension is going to drive right through, is that a home that's already built and has people living in it, or is that a prospective home that they expect to build?
Three questions. My inference from the story, and of course this is only part of it, is it was pre-existing.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't say whether or not anybody was living in it, but that it is not planned. So my inference was that it is a pre-existing structure.
Well, that's what my inference is as well. But I think unless it's sort of more conclusively said in parts of the article that haven't been excerpted, I don't know how useful that inference is. I would rather know for sure whether this is actually going to, you know, impact somebody's quality of life measurably by taking away the place that they live, in which case there is more of a point to consider.
Let me insert this then. In the story, it did say that this would be going through a subdivision, a pre-existing subdivision. I don't know whether the city already has the right of way or there would be some eminent domain condemnation. Didn't say. The developers is saying that they would like to add more amenities in that area so that residents of the subdivision didn't. I mean, this is why it was hyper-local, right? So that residents wouldn't have to travel as far to get to those amenities, and that by extending this road and taking up that land, that those amenities would no longer be able to be developed. So, I mean, there were all those different things. But, I mean, essentially what this comes down to is, you know, one of the reasons that Houston developers give for not having zoning is if you start to do zoning, then people who own property bought that property under a misapprehension, unless it's like grandfathered. Also that it prevents landowners from getting the maximum value out of their property. So I think the important thing here is that it's necessary to really be forward thinking about this so that current landowners' concerns are addressed in the event that you begin to do zoning. And then once you have zoning in place, future landowners, land buyers, prospectively, would then know what they are getting. So I don't think there's any reason for Houston not to do zoning. And I mean, I think it would be a good thing.
Yeah.
But I think anyhow, so that's why I didn't, you know, like read the book. But there you have a greater digest.
Okay.
So the next story from the Texas Tribune. And it's hard to believe this isn't like a satire. Texas power grid leaders say they're confident the lights will stay on this summer. Texas Public Utility Commissioner Chair Peter Lake and ERCOT, reliability, ERCOT President Brad Jones said the power grid is prepared for record-breaking summer electricity demand. Texas PUC Commissioner Peter Lake was appointed by Governor Greg Abbott after last year's deadly winter storm to regulate utilities and to oversee the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, laughingly named, I might add. He said there will be more reserve power available to the grid this summer than in previous summers, a necessary cushion that Mr. Lake said reflects a different approach than before last February's disaster. Lake spoke confidently about, do I have satire dripping from my voice? I hope so. Lake spoke confidently about the grid's summer readiness on Tuesday alongside ERCOT President Brad Jones, who also said he has no concerns about this summer. Jones expressed some caution about, quote, times that are dark and still, meaning when the sun isn't shining to produce solar power and when wind isn't blowing enough to produce wind energy. They said their agencies are better prepared for times when there is likely to be a smaller share of energy generated by renewable sources. Lake and Jones said they didn't have concerns about natural gas-fired power plants, the largest source of electricity generation on the power grid, despite having to ask Texans to reduce their power consumption just this past Friday after six power plants unexpectedly broke down. Lakin Jones said, asking Texans to conserve electricity is a tool they use to ensure the reliability of the power supply and should not be viewed as a sign that the grid is unstable. Conservation is a good thing, Jones said. Conservation is what we should do every day in our lives. Lakin Jones didn't reveal new information on Friday's outages beyond Jones noting that the six plants that went down between noon and 4 p.m. that day, in the days and weeks before the plant failures, ERCOT had asked several energy companies to delay their scheduled maintenance in order to keep up the hotter than expected, keep up rather with the hotter than expected May weather. At least one of the plants that delayed repairs broke down Friday, and industry officials said others did too. There's kind of a companion article that I've cited from communityimpact.com. One of the things that I thought is interesting, and it pays to go to the article link I've provided, they have a graph that ERCOT has provided information, and it shows comparatively power peak demand versus generation capacity from the summer of 2017 through the summer of so far 2022. When you first look at it, it kind of looks like demand is in a straight line across, but it actually isn't. It actually does veer up slightly. And then from the, I guess, between the summer of 2015 and 2018 and 2019, it shows they had the least generation capacity, but that has increased to a peak above what has been previously available by this summer. I think, you know, there's an old saying that there are three kinds of lies, lies, damned lies, and statistics. And looking at this chart, which I will try to include in my blog post, but I can't promise. I think, first of all, what you're seeing is a summer to summer average. And what it's not showing is daily or weekly peaks, which could perhaps exceed capacity. And then, of course, you're seeing the average capacity, which on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis may vary. And also, I think you would have to assume it is the most optimistic projection that ERCOT can offer. So I think in yielding to his temptation to use superlatives, Peter Lake both missed the irony of his statement and his error. Since I've been in Houston over 40 years, and it seems to me that the Texas grid has never been less reliable than it's ever been, but maybe it's just me. Andrew?
In the times that are dark and still, the dragon comes down from the mountain to terrorize the good Texan countryside. So say the wizards of air. Anyway.
Okay, that I was not expecting. We may have to get more of your elvish singing in the future.
Okay. That was less elvish singing and more wizened old wizard storytelling. But
okay. Well, I'm old.
Yeah. So, another highlight of this article, conservation is a good thing. Yes, yes, it is. But that's when we want to reduce our electricity usage, not when we have to because six of the plants are broken. That's, I mean, this is one story in the latest story in a string of stories that we have seen recently about ERCOT essentially just kind of not really being up to the task of running an entire state's electricity grid. I mean, I saw...
Should we call it ERCOTless?
ERCOTless.
Is that a thing that might catch on?
It could be. We'll have to mull it over in our minds a bit, I think, but it could be. I saw a Twitter thread by Shelby Webb, who is an energy reporter for the Houston Chronicle. And there's some quite interesting research that she's done here. This is all on her Twitter, obviously, so it hasn't been, gone through an editor or, it's somewhat cursory, so there could be inaccuracies in this sort of thing. But it does seem to line up with the kinds of things we've heard before about ERCOT. One of the things that really hit me about her research here was that there are areas of Texas, there are counties in Texas, literally right next to each other, where because of the distribution of renewable energy generation facilities, there can be a county where the price of electricity is quite literally hundreds of dollars in the negative, and then immediately in
per megawatt,
and immediately in the next county over, it can be $800, $1,000. Like it is ridiculous. And the reason that Shelby Webb thinks this is, and the reason that makes sense to me personally, is that ERCOT is just so bad at actually maintaining its distribution network, its infrastructure.
But succession ready.
Yeah, that's the sort of trade-off that we've decided apparently is worth it, is at any moment we could declare ourselves an independent state from an independent nation again, and we could cut our few tenuous links to the outside grid, but all we have to do to be ready for that is have a grid that doesn't function in the winter and doesn't function when it's too hot either.
Yeah, it's great if it isn't too hot or too cold, then yeah. Our grid is perfect. And of course, when Brad Jones said, well, you know, you can't rely on the sun and wind stuff because sometimes it's not shiny and sometimes it's not windy. But during the freeze, that was the most reliable part of the grid.
Yeah, like I can understand that it would be nice to have a more reliable system of batteries for renewable energy. But
or more reliable gas-powered plants, which apparently we don't necessarily have.
Yeah, but to say that we can't rely on renewables at this point because we don't have the big batteries figured out yet is totally, totally wrong. It's totally a word I can't use on the radio.
Yeah, BS.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever that word would be. Okay. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honegun, KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can also listen online. You can podcast. You can go to archive.kpft.org. Do remember, every story on this show is heavily excerpted, so I link to full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Click on show posts and more at the top of my webpage, thinkwingradio.com, and find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. You can also type keywords into the search bar. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. We would look forward. You can also check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. Look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio, and Andrew has his accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk far-left politics, and make stupid jokes, much like the one that you heard from me on that ERCOT story. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
But that wasn't a stupid joke. That was impressive singing. I think that there's actually some potential there. We'll have to discuss it. Okay. Our next story from NativeNewsOnline.net. Duwamish tribe prepares to sue federal government to secure tribal sovereignty. The Duwamish tribe has lived in the Seattle area since time immemorial, though the tribe signed the Treaty of Elliott Point in 1855, creating a government-to-government relationship with the U.S. that is still not federally recognized. This week, the Duwamish tribe plans to file a lawsuit against the U.S. federal government to defend its tribal sovereignty. The tribe wrote in a media advisory on Tuesday, from 1859, when the Treaty of Point Elliott was ratified, until at least 2001, Congress and other federal authorities have unambiguously recognized the Duwamish tribe. Yet today, the U.S. Department of Interior refuses to officially recognize the Duwamish tribe in violation of the U.S. Constitution and other federal laws. The lawsuit will be filed in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of the State of Washington. Over 100,000 people have signed the Duwamish tribe's petition for federal recognition. I provided a link. I mean, this is, in a sense, very simple. Treaties are part of national law. And everyone deserves equal treatment and protection under the law. This essentially is a treaty between two nations, the Duwamish tribe, which was a sovereign Native American nation, and the U.S. government, in which the Duwamish tribe became essentially, although this isn't how it's usually framed, a protectorate of the U.S. with autonomous rights and also a certain amount of dependence on the U.S. So it's just a matter of, hey, you know, we have to obey the treaties we have agreed to. Andrew?
I absolutely agree. We need to obey the treaties that we've agreed to. I think the potential complicating factor is that a lot of those treaties, at least from the perspective of the indigenous peoples, were signed with the understanding that they would retain all of their autonomy and would not become protectorates, which is not the understanding that the U.S. had of it. So I think to comply with the letter of these treaties is one thing that I think is an easier sell for the majority of people. I think to comply with perhaps the spirit of them, which I think that would require kind of relinquishing U.S. control over quite a lot of land that it has sort of annexed over its existence, which I think is a harder sell depending on how patriotic a particular person is feeling.
Well, let me ask you a question. What are you talking about full autonomy? I mean, are you talking full autonomy like retaining the right to declare war and keep a standing army? Well, that's independence. That's not autonomy. They are autonomy. Yeah. They have their own court system. They have their own police forces. But they are not independent. They are, I guess, what you would call semi-autonomous.
Yeah, I would argue that independence is full autonomy. That's what I would argue the two are equivalent.
I don't think that they're commonly used that way in this context, which would make the word perhaps a little misleading unclear.
Okay, well, for clarity, what I mean to say by full autonomy is independence, legal, ethical, moral, political, de jure, whatever, however you want to describe it, in every sense of the word, independence.
So you're advocating essentially what would amount to the fragmentation of...
Yeah, I think that we meaning the United States, had agreed to treaties that did not explicitly lay out in clear terms for all parties that you will become part of our nation and part of our jurisdiction.
I don't think either of us is qualified to say that, not having read the treaties, unless you have.
I have read some of them, and I have read the interpretations of them by both non-Indigenous legal scholars and Indigenous legal scholars, as well as just Indigenous leaders.
So your understanding would be that these Indian nations would have retained the right to raise armies?
Yeah.
Declare war in the United States?
Yeah, these are rights that they never consciously gave up. And so...
Okay, let's not talk about consciously or unconsciously. You said you have read parts, at least, of the treaties.
Yeah.
Were the treaties explicit in this area?
The problem with a lot of these treaties is that they are written in both English and the native language of the...
Okay, let's keep this to the English version.
Okay, the English version is vague. The English version, I would argue, is intentionally vague on a lot of these fronts. It does not explicitly lay out whether they would become annexed or whether they would not become annexed in a lot of these cases. And so that is where the argument comes in, where, you know, it's not laid out in the English version. We never consciously agreed to it. So there's an argument that, you know, the indigenous nations argue there is an argument to say we never agreed to become part of the United States. Obviously, as with many topics on this show, both of our commentary is purely based off of what we've heard and what we understand in, you know, the most good faith way possible with the most references that we can add. So there's going to be some references on the blog post at thinkwingradio.com. They're relevant. Go click on them. If you don't know much about this issue, they're a good place to start. We basically doing whatever we can to honor the treaties that the United States agreed to but did not in action honor is a good step in the right direction towards reconciliation.
And actually, before the show, Andrew reminded me of something we have discussed previously, which was a Native American case in the state of Oklahoma, where the court ultimately ruled that like half the state of Oklahoma really should be considered part of the reservation.
Mm.
And the state is going to have to figure out how to retroactively comply with that and where jurisdictions are going to overlap, et cetera. So, I mean, justice, you know, if justice doesn't come in an individual's lifetime, did that person ever get justice? But hopefully at least a people may ultimately get some degree of justice.
Mm.
This is Thinkwing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. KPFT is Houston's community station with over 100 show titles. To do that means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied programming. You can go to the new kpft.org webpage and hit the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, hopefully ours, and the amount of your donation, large, smaller, in between, and you may qualify for a lovely thank you gift, or you can let it ride and get a bigger tax deduction and more goes to KPFT. And remember, spreading the word helps too, and it's free.
Hmm.
Okay, our next story is from WashingtonPost.com. It's an opinion piece. The Supreme Court greenlights political corruption again. This is from the Post editorial board. The Supreme Court sided with Senator Ted Cruz on Monday in the conservative majority's latest assault on the laws meant to fight political corruption. Their decision will enable campaign donors to funnel money into candidates' personal bank accounts, revealing stunning indifference to the corrosive effects this could have on how the nation is governed and public confidence in those doing the governing. The court opinion, written by Chief Justice John Roberts Jr., concerns when and how candidates may be repaid for personal loans they make to their campaigns. Federal rules previously barred candidates from taking more than $250,000 in repayment from their campaigns if that money came from donations made after Election Day. Important point. The logic is obvious, as Justice Elena Kagan explained in a dissent, quote, political contributions that will line a candidate's own pockets given after his election to office pose a special danger of corruption. The candidate has a more than usual interest in obtaining money to replenish his personal finances and is now in a position to give something in return. The donors well understand this situation and are eager to take advantage of it. In short, everyone's incentives are stacked to enhance the risk of dirty dealing. The editorial goes on, if anything, the rules permitting $250,000 in post-election repayments were too weak. Chief Justice Roberts dismissed such concerns, arguing that the regulations burden candidates funding their own campaigns and therefore their First Amendment rights. In fact, the rules that the court struck down limited the extent to which donors, not candidates, could help. Candidates have been free to spend as much of their personal wealth as they liked on their political careers. They just could not expect that others would pay them back for it. Roberts argued that, quote, we are talking about repayment of a loan, not a gift, emphasizing that the donations merely, quote, restore the candidate to the status quo ante. This reasoning is either naive or cynical. Making someone whole and simply handing them money are economically equivalent. Either way, a politician is obtaining direct financial benefits from a donor. Not to worry, the Chief Justice argued. Federal law, for the moment, prohibits donors from contributing more than $2,900 to a campaign, so the risk of corruption is still limited. In the real world, $2,900 going into a personal bank account is not negligible. And big fundraisers who bundle contributions from others have become very adept at raising legally far larger sums for candidates, as well as making it clear whom those candidates owe. Congress passed a landmark campaign finance law in 2002 after decades of declining trust in government. Supreme Court conservatives have steadily dismantled it, relying on a tenuous conflation of money with speech. Monday's ruling is another chapter in this sorry tale, the moral of which is when big donors pick up the tab for a candidate, it is the public that usually pays. For those interested, the individuals who make up the Post editorial board for this piece are listed at the bottom of the article. I think that the slippery slope started when corporations were declared people. And people have free speech, therefore it was decided corporations have free speech. And since people can donate money to campaigns as free speech, that means that corporations can do the same. And I think that there are two root problems here. Well, not here with Ted Cruz, but I think generally speaking.
Ted Cruz has more than two core problems.
Yeah, he does. I think that first of all, considering corporations as people for the purposes of things like free speech and maybe other parts of the Constitution are, in my lay opinion, not correct.
Yeah.
I understand the reason for having a business collective like a corporation, but I don't think that's the same as a corporation having all the rights as a person because they can't be imprisoned or executed, for example. I think another problem, and maybe we need a constitutional amendment for this, among other things, is conflating money with speech. Speech is something that is not guaranteed to be widely promoted. You have the right to say anything you want at any time you want. In public, on public property, on private property, or in a private business, the government has no power to decide what can be censored and what cannot. The government itself cannot make laws censoring, which, by the way, brings up things like school books and library books and stuff like that. But anyhow, I mean, this is way down that slippery slope. Andrew?
Yeah, I'd just like to point out the sort of I know that these are two different organs, but I think that it is somewhat interesting that we have the Supreme Court making these judgments that allow candidates to essentially just pocket donations on grand scales like this, whereas at the same time, the FEC is going after Jill Stein for using some of the presidential campaign funds to try and get on the ballot in some states, which is, I just think that's a very interesting contradiction there. In terms of the actual article here, I totally agree with every point you just made. there is no real reasonable justification to give corporations or I forget the term. I'm blanking on the term now.
Individuals?
No. committees like to PACs, political action
like
committees.
CREEP, Nixon's Committee to Reelect the President, which was yes. never a more appropriate acronym.
Yeah. Or to give these kinds of groups the same legal rights as individuals, because while they are, yes, made up of individuals, they themselves are not individuals because they have vastly more power than an individual has because they're a multitude of individuals. You know, it's you multiply the impact because you have more people involved. Anyway,
there was once a TV show called Reaper, and I actually have the full quote among my records. But the essence of it was corporations were designed essentially to be psychopathic in nature. That they do things with no consideration for the consequences of their actions because they are, by definition, not responsible for anything they do in any real punishable sense.
Yeah.
They're basically psychopathic collectives. Yeah. Something to think about.
Why would you want to give a collective that is totally self-interested, motivated by absolutely nothing else, and really can't be motivated by anything else, the ability to influence our elections en masse? Why would we think that's a good idea? Ask the Republicans.
Of course, collectives gets us into another, be that as it. okay, I'm going to do a block of several stories here. In this block, we're going to talk about the Equal Rights Amendment, how it might relate to Roe versus Wade, the legal outcomes around the Equal Rights Amendment, which has kind of fallen below the radar, and how might this impact women's health care if and when it became the 28th Amendment to the Constitution. So the Equal Rights Amendment is actually incredibly short. There are three sections. Each one is a sentence. And the only sentence that is actually germane to the amendment is equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Simple, right? So a good amendment is something with enough specificity to be helpful and enough vagueness to be interpretable, because you can't possibly word something to account for every possible future contingency. So I thought it would be interesting to sort of go through a sequence here. From March 22nd, there is an article from NPR.org. 50 years ago, sex equality seemed destined for the Constitution. What happened? 50 years ago, the U.S. Senate passed the Equal Rights Amendment following the lead of the House of Representatives and paving the way for it to become the 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Yet the ERA was never added to the Constitution because Congress also set a deadline. It said three-quarters of the states had to ratify the proposed amendment by 1979. It later extended the deadline to 1982. So when, in 2020, Virginia became the final state needed to ratify the ERA, it was almost 40 years too late. Or was it? Even with the Virginia vote 2 years ago, victory may be a long way off. Five states have tried to rescind their ratification, though it's not clear from the Constitution if this is possible. There are people suing to push the ERA through, and those pushing to have it blocked. The Trump Justice Department advised that because the deadline had passed, Congress needed to go back to the drawing board. But last year, the House passed a joint resolution to remove the deadline, which President Joe Biden says he supports. As written, the proposed Equal Rights Amendment is a pretty simple idea. Alice Paul, an American Quaker suffragist, first introduced the ERA to Congress in 1923. But discrimination continued. Until 1974, banks made it tough for women to get credit cards. Until 1978, being pregnant could get you fired. Kim Ford Mesrui, director of the Center for the Study of Race and Law at the University of Virginia, takes the view that the Supreme Court's use of strict scrutiny, based on its reading of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, leads to a kind of colorblindness that ignores historic and systemic racism. She says, or he says rather, the Supreme Court's rule that race should be generally ignored has actually prevented policies that could help to reduce the racial gap. He added that the ERA, as currently written, could cause the Supreme Court to treat sex the same way, with a kind of sex blindness, prohibiting policies that are intentionally designed to open up opportunities for women. So there's that. Then there's the next story, also from March 22nd, an opinion piece from thehill.com. Will the Supreme Court strike down the Equal Rights Amendment? In the 40 years since the expiration of the ratification deadline in 1982, three additional states ratified the ERA, Nevada, Illinois, and Virginia in 2020. Proponents now argue that the ERA has been duly ratified by the 38 states required for officialdom and that it should be properly recognized as a valid amendment to the Constitution. Opponents, on the other hand, argue that the original ratification deadline must stand and that the three post-92 ratifications are legally invalid. So who is right? The Supreme Court may ultimately have to rule whether the ERA is now the 28th Amendment. There are many questions of constitutional law to resolve, and only the court can resolve them authoritatively. For example, does an amendment proposal ever expire? The text of the original Constitution is silent on how quickly states must ratify an amendment proposal. But what if Congress imposes a ratification deadline? Does that congressional action trump constitutional silence? That word. And are states bound by the deadline? These are key questions today at the center of the battle over the ratification of the ERA. A second set of questions concerns whether a state can revoke its earlier ratification. In the years since the ERA was proposed in 1972, a handful of states have revoked their prior ratification of the amendment. If these states can legally rescind their prior ratification, fewer than 38 states have validly ratified the ERA. The question for the court then will be whether a state may ratify an amendment and then revoke that ratification before the amendment becomes official. The Constitution is silent on this point, too. These questions will confront the Supreme Court with an extraordinary question. Can a constitutional amendment be unconstitutional? The court could well choose to punt the ball, declining to hear the case because of the political question doctrine, which advises federal courts against hearing disputes that are best resolved in the political process. Yet, the court could alternatively hear the case and limit its final judgment to narrow procedural grounds about what amounts to a proper or improper rescission and ratification of an amendment. The court has never struck down an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but the procedural irregularities surrounding the ERA could ultimately give the court a reason to do it for the first time. So how might a formal ratification of the ERA affect something like Roe v. Wade? Should Congress try to pass a new proposed amendment with different wording that might be a more effective tool for women's rights generally or abortion rights specifically? And what snowball in hell might be able to accomplish that? Andrew?
Well, I can't say whether I think it would be whether we would be better served by a new draft or not. But I do. This is obviously a complex issue, which is why it's not resolved yet. But I think one particular aspect of this discussion that does interest me, and one that I sort of have formulated an opinion on, is the idea that the ERA could, you know, have a limiting effect on policies that are designed to not only push for more equality, but push for more equity in terms of, you know, treatment under the law. I think that that is a very real concern, but I'm not sure that the ERA is the problem there. I think it's honestly, I think it's one of those things where, depending on who you have in a court, in the or whatever the decision making body is, what their biases are, what their political aims are, what their opinions are, and what their principles are, even, is determines how they will act when it comes time to say, this thing is intended to right a wrong, to you know, address a specific problem and make it right.
I think the ERA is what you might call the bird in the hand, whereas, yeah, you know, it's sort of don't let the enemy of the good be the perfect.
Yes.
And that's not to say that we couldn't have a better potential constitutional amendment. And
sure,
just because the ERA might eventually become an amendment does not prevent us possibly from a more forward-thinking, inclusive amendment in the future.
Yeah.
But I think to fight for the ratification of the ERA is to fight for the bird in the hand.
Yeah, I think in both addressing the problem with race blindness and sex blindness, I think it's less a problem of is having this commitment to equal treatment under the law harming us achieving equal treatment under the law, and is it more that the people in power are not willing to, you know, allow for the notion of equity rather than equality. I think it's a decisionary thing.
Well, one of the things that was noted in one of the articles that I excerpted out, mm-hmm, is that if the ERA had passed in 1972, it would have influenced a lot of laws and legal decisions that have established or restricted various rights and privileges in the decades since.
Yeah.
So to ratify it now kind of retroactively creates a little confusion, apparently, for a number of different decisions that have been developed over the decades, and then subsequent decisions based on those as precedent.
Because they'd have to be updated to reflect the new amendment.
Essentially, yes. In other words, the decisions that were constitutional then might not be quite as constitutional if the ERA is ultimately ratified.
Yes.
But again, my personal view, better the bird in the hand than the two in the.
Mm-hmm.
There was an article that I thought was interesting from The Guardian, and it's sort of a cautionary tale about what might be in store for women in the United States if Roe v. Wade actually ends up being overruled. The story is El Salvador. A woman is sentenced to 30 years in prison for homicide after a miscarriage. Activists say case offers a stark warning to women in the U.S. where the Supreme Court is considering overturning Roe v. Wade. Court in El Salvador has sentenced a woman who suffered a miscarriage to 30 years in prison for aggravated homicide in a case which activists say offers a stark warning to women in the U.S. where the Supreme Court is considering overturning the key ruling. The woman, identified only as Esme, was sentenced on Monday after nearly 2 years under pretrial detention following her arrest when she sought medical care in a public hospital. An international civil rights lawyer and executive director of the Women's Equality Center warned that as the U.S. faces the possible overturning of Roe v. Wade, similar cases will become more common across the world. El Salvador has some of the world's most draconian abortion laws, with a total ban on the procedure. Unlike in many other Latin American countries, El Salvador does not permit abortion in cases where the child is conceived by rape or incest, or where the health of the mother or child is at risk. Over the past two decades, more than 180 women have been jailed for murder in El Salvador for having an abortion after suffering obstetric emergencies, according to rights groups. Since December, 8 women serving long prison sentences have had those sentences commuted. So, you know, again, this becomes a question of if the Equal Rights Amendment were ever ratified, would it provide protection for women wanting or needing an abortion? Or would it be legally neutral, or would it have some unintended negative consequence? Andrew?
I don't know the answer to that question. I think it, and I don't know that there is a single answer. I think it will depend on which scholars you ask and what cases they've read and how they've interpreted them. Because the thing about constitutional amendments is you can read them a lot of different ways. And you can interpret them in a lot of different ways. And different people, different politicians in power at different times will interpret them in different ways. So it is, unfortunately, not a clear-cut answer, which makes the whole thing even more tricky than it already is.
And of course, what we may end up learning from the Roe v. Wade question before the Supreme Court now is, even having determined what the answer is is that the final answer, as they used to say on quiz shows? And of course, if something can be overturned depending on the ideological composition of the Supreme Court, does any decision matter? Or is it just like legislation that can be replaced by new legislation? That is really the integrity question that's facing the court right now. It isn't just Roe v. Wade, as important as that is.
Yeah.
It's a matter of how seriously should we take any decision by the Supreme Court if some future Supreme Court can just decide never mind?
Yeah.
Our next story is from the Washington Post. The U.S. sues to compel casino mogul Steve Wynn to register as an agent of China. The DOJ on Tuesday sued Wynn to compel him to register as an agent of China. The suit, filed in U.S. District Court in D.C., argues that Wynn, former executive of Wynn Resorts, leveraged his relationship with President Trump and members of his administration to advance Beijing's interests in 2017. The government said the complaint is the first affirmative civil lawsuit under the Foreign Agents Registration Act in more than 30 years, a sign of stepped-up enforcement efforts under the 1983 law. Wynn, a former finance chairman of the Republican National Committee, is accused of relaying a request from a senior Chinese official asking that the Trump administration remove a Chinese national who had sought asylum in the United States. His activities, prosecutors assert in the lawsuit, included discussing Beijing's interest directly with Trump during a dinner in June 2017 and providing the Chinese national's passport photos to the president's secretary. Wynn, the government argues, was acting at the behest of the Chinese official, Sun Lijun, then a vice minister for public security, as well as of the Chinese government itself. In so doing, the complaint states, from at least June 2017 through at least August 2017, the defendant acted as an agent for foreign principals Sun and the People's Republic of China and engaged in political activities on their behalf in the United States. At the time, Wynn had significant business interests involving China, owning and operating casinos in Macau, and acted out of a desire to protect his business, the Justice Department alleged. Wynn was advised three times, beginning in 2018 during the Trump years, and finally last month to register under FARA, but declined to do so, according to the complaint. The Justice Department has said Wynn was approached to work with China by longtime GOP and Trump fundraiser Elliot Broidy, who worked under Wynn as deputy RNC finance chairman after Trump's 2016 election as president. Broidy pleaded guilty in October 2020 to acting as an unregistered foreign agent, admitting to accepting millions of dollars to secretly lobby the Trump administration for Malaysian and Chinese interests. Broidy agreed to cooperate with prosecutors in exchange for a recommendation of leniency at sentencing and to forfeit $6.6 million, but was granted a full pardon by Trump the day he left office in January 2021. So, you know, I mentioned this in our pre-show chat, and I hesitate to mention it on the air, but I think I'm going to anyhow. You know, sometimes I wonder if the modern, contemporary Republican Party, in its functional entirety, should perhaps register as a foreign agent. It sometimes seems that way. Andrew?
Well, I can tell you that comment is, I think, decidedly less perhaps dangerous now that we don't have callers.
Actually, that might have made for a very interesting series of conversations.
Oh, I think it would have.
And I want to clarify, I don't mean to say that every Republican is potentially an agent of a foreign power. But I think it seems like an awful lot of big contributors and elected officials and party officials in the hierarchies, I mean, there seems to be a lot of like pro-Russia, pro-Chinese, against what might be considered U.S. interests. It's alarming.
Well, I would push back on that, but what I think is a more interesting comment. On the one hand, which means that there's another hand following in Mike.
Yes.
On the one hand, I think FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, and the sort of tone in which it's meant and the tone in which discussions around it are often had kind of plays into this style of politics, geopolitical politics, as geopolitical politics, whatever, Department of Redundancy Department, as an adversarial game, which I don't think is productive, and I don't think it was ever productive. I don't think it was ever productive, but I think that it was more reflective of reality in the past than I think it is today. On the other hand,
just to note, this also applies to people working in the interest of an allied foreign nation.
Okay, fair enough. On the other hand, this is the Republican Party we're talking about. Regardless of whether we agree or not with the aims of the foreign agents they may be working for, we can take solace in the fact that the Republican Party will just do whatever's in their best interest, regardless of whether they agree with it or not, or think it's moral or not. It has no bearing to them. It has no relevance to them. They will just do whatever they can profit from, whether that's financially or politically or whatever. So I don't know. I think I'm wary of, you know, going to what I think is going to be some people's knee-jerk reaction of, oh, this is, you know, clearly foreign interference and we need to be more suspicious of outsiders. But also, you know, there is clearly a problem here.
Well, I don't know that this is a matter of judging. Sorry. I mean, I don't know that this is so much a matter of judging foreign interference as it is a U.S. citizen interceding with a high official of the United States government on behalf of a foreign nation without disclosing that they have interested reasons to be advocating for that foreign nation. I mean, it's the Foreign Agent Registration Act isn't necessarily a matter of registering agents for hostile powers. It's just a matter of registering lobbyists who are lobbying for the interests of a foreign nation, or politicians who are doing so, or business people who are doing so. It isn't to paint them necessarily with the brush of potential enemy agents. It's just you're acting as a lobbyist for a foreign power one way or another.
Okay. I guess in that term, in that frame of looking at it, it's more of a conflict of interest disclosure kind of thing, which I think is easier to swallow and digest. But, you know, I think that it's worth considering, can this be taken in a way that is jingoistic? And that's a question worth keeping in mind with a lot of things, not just this policy, a lot of policies.
So. As a question, that's fair. For our last story, this is actually from April 19th, but I think it's still timely. Russia ducks blame for blowing up global food chains. This is from polygraph.info, which is produced by Voice of America. On April 14th, the United Nations Security Council held a meeting on the political and humanitarian situation in war-torn Yemen. During the meeting, U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, cited Russia's war of choice in Ukraine as the main reason wheat prices in Yemen are rising, worsening the dire humanitarian situation in the country. She said Yemen is one of the countries most vulnerable to rising wheat prices. But Dmitry Polyansky, Russia's deputy UN ambassador, responded by trying to shift blame onto Western countries and the sanctions they've imposed on Russia. He said those countries must recognize their responsibility for causing the crisis in the financial food markets. Polyansky said the main factor for instability and the source of the problem today is not the Russian special military operation in Ukraine, but sanctions measures imposed on our country, Russia, seeking to cut off any supplies from Russia and the supply chain. But, the article goes on, that is misleading. In fact, Russia's blockade of Ukrainian ports is preventing food shipments from reaching the world. Some ready-to-ship crops stored on docked ships could spoil, worsening the impact of Russia's war on Ukrainian farmers' ability to raise wheat and other crops. The UN meeting on Yemen came a day after the UN Global Crisis Response Group on Food, Energy, and Finance created following Russia's invasion of Ukraine issued its first report. Millions of people in developing countries depend on Ukraine's wheat harvest. They include countries like Egypt, Lebanon, and Yemen. On April 15th, Ukrainian Agricultural Minister Mykola Solskaya said up to 1.25 million tons of grain and oil seed being carried on 57 vessels could rot because of the Russian blockade. Those vessels are among the scores of ships that have been stuck near Ukraine's seaports for 2 months since Russia invaded. 2 months at the time, three perhaps now. Ukraine and Russia together produce 30% of the world's traded wheat and 12% of its calories, National Geographic reported. Without Ukrainian and Russian food exports, the world could see a wave of instability similar to the 2012 Arab Spring. Since Russia's attack began, U.S. and European Union governments imposed waves of economic sanctions on Russia. Moscow has been blaming those sanctions for causing the food crisis. The article goes on to point out that things like insurance rates have gone up and fear of being near the war zone in the Black Sea makes a lot of countries hesitant to do trade there, as well as the possibility of violating sanctions and getting into legal trouble. Reading this article again, I was kind of struck how it kind of reminds me of the trade wars in the 1930s, except in this particular case, we've got food insecurities, which are seeing nations try basically to look out for their own food security. So, for example, India decided to stop exporting grain because they had some crop failures due to heat waves. So now that's more grain off the market. So this could end up being kind of a compounding problem, not only because of actual, but problems in trading in grain, getting it moving from one to another. Andrew?
First, as a quick bias possible heads up, polygraph.info, affiliated with Voice of America, look into that. But in terms of the actual article, I think obviously the war is having an impact on the state of food supply internationally, obviously. It is a war of aggression on Russia's part. It is not helped by the encroach of NATO on their borders, but war is not the first response to that. So obviously it is having an impact. It is having a significant impact. I think other factors that may be having an impact may be growing conditions. Like you mentioned, India has had crop failures because of the heat there. That is obviously not helping matters. I think that the whole situation is leading to countries focusing on feeding their own, which is understandable, perhaps, but may aggravate the situation elsewhere. So,
well, just like people, countries look out for number one when push comes to shove. When the United States had the vaccine against COVID, there was a lot of argument about, well, you've got countries that have already contracted for vaccine.
Yeah.
Do the companies honor the contracts or do they say, never mind, we need it for domestic consumption? So, you get into these things.
And you had to quickly bring it back to our corporation's people. You had the arguments about copyright over the vaccines. Is it ethical to copyright something that is so desperately needed in those situations? Well, people
or
have
is it
right
essential
to
be able to copyright something in order for companies to feel it's worth investing their time and money in inventing something?
And that was the debate. So.
And that was the debate. Okay. You've been listening to Think Wing. You know, it's like Bill Maher. We should go into overtime now. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's community station 90.1 KPFT HD2. My co-host, indispensable editor, patient and occasionally verbose co-host. I'm sorry.
Assistant producer. That's accurate.
Yeah. Okay. Whatever. Hope you found the show interesting. And we'll be back next week, all things being equal. Take care.
We'll get it right one of these days. See you later.
Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? Not too late, we should be giving.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! KPFT has gone through some very big changes in the last couple of years, and one thing it's working to do is to find a new home for new studios. Nevertheless, KPFT has kept on bringing you the news and views you won't hear anywhere else on the radio. In order to continue to do that, we're asking for your support. Whatever you can give, $5, $50, $500, it all goes towards new digs for the station and continuing to maintain and improve the service KPFT gives to you and the whole community. If KPFT is important to you, please make an online donation at kpft.org. That's kpft.org. Or you can call 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT, 713-526-5738. And thank you so much.
Hi, this is the Blues Hound.
And I'm Colleen.
Please join us on Sundays between the hours of 2 and 5 p.m. for Hound the Blues, where you'll hear us spinning the best new blues releases we can get our hands on. Whether it's the newest contemporary artist or simply old school cool, we'll bring the blues to you in all of its many flavors, commercial free and with as little talk as possible.
Thanks for inviting us into your homes each week and giving us the privilege to serve as your link to the blues world and our local blues community.
That's Hound the Blues, Sundays from 2 to 5 p.m. right here on 90.1 FM KPFT. Houston's community station.